I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. On a recent weekend in Philadelphia, four people were murdered and a number were wounded in a series of attacks over the course of just a few hours. This Monday night, a limousine driver was shot to death in the Feltonville section of the city. This is an all-too-common event in some Philadelphia neighborhoods. The city has a distressingly high rate of homicide, and the weapon of choice tends to be a gun. So why is this happening and what can be done about it? Our guests have been working to stem the violence in Philadelphia. Let me introduce them to you. Jim McMillan is co-founder of Gun Crisis Philadelphia Project. It's an open source reporting community working on the epidemic of homicide by gunfire in Philadelphia. He teaches peace and conflict journalism at Swarthmore College. He also was a member of the Pulitzer Prize winning Associated Press photo staff in Iraq. He was in Iraq from 2004 to 2005. And Jim has been a number of years. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us is Scott Charles. He's the Trauma Outreach Coordinator for Temple University Hospital in Philadelphia. He's director of the Cradle to Grave program. That's an award-winning hospital-based violence prevention initiative. He's also a member of St. Joseph's University Richard Johnson Center for Anti-Violence. And Scott, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
Scott, let me begin with you. Is this summer different from other summers in Philadelphia?
I hate to say it. I don't know that it is. I think that we are paying a lot of attention to it. It's in the forefront of our minds right now. But having been in North Philadelphia at the hospital for the last 7.5 years, it seems pretty consistent with what we expect during the summers.
And do we expect more violence, more
well,
shootings in the summer?
At least anecdotally, we think that there's a spike in the summer. We come to expect it much in the way that healthcare professionals will tell you that with a full moon that you expect to see more emergency room cases. I don't know how rigorous the research is around that, but certainly when you look at the data in the city, you do see an increase during the summers over when compared to winter months.
And is that because people are literally just outside?
Yeah, you know, that's what I think. I think there's been a lot of research that's focused on trying to pin down what makes summers busier for when it comes to violence. But it's been hard to replicate that research in the laboratory, obviously. What I suspect is that it's just about opportunity and individuals being in close proximity to one another. It's hot inside, so they come outside for relief, and unfortunately they run into people with whom they have conflict.
I want to pick up on some of that, but Jim, let me get you in on the conversation. Help us understand, what is this Gun Crisis Philadelphia project about? What is the mission, the goal of this project?
Well, the ultimate goal is to stop the killing, and it's a pretty lofty goal, but it seems like we can make a difference. And the turning point for me was a conference last year, coincidentally here at WHYY, led by the Dart Center for Journalism and Trauma, where I added to my knowledge. Well, you know, my background was I was a street photographer for a long time. I covered a lot of violence in Philadelphia when I worked for the Daily News, and have been studying different aspects of journalism. But the missing link for me was the public health perspective. So I launched the site in an effort to look for any solution that might work and to see what's working in various corners of the city and to check in on all the grassroots groups and others and individuals working to mediate violence. But when I learned about the public health aspect, it was new to me. The idea that the outbreak of violence was not unlike other communicable diseases, and the idea that, well, then we know how to treat that sort of problem by interrupting the transmission of the violence and by teaching people to think and to behave differently. And I could go on all day, but yeah. that's where I find the enthusiasm, that's where I find my optimism, and the more I read, the more I feel like we can do this.
Well, I've been looking at your website, and it seems that the website also bears witness to these events. Some of them end up in murder, some mm-hmm. people end up in the hospital, but to bear witness to what has been happening.
So it's a delicate balance, and I'm doing my best to get it right and listening very closely to the feedback. Most of the field reports so far is coming from one of my primary partners, Joe Kaczmarek, who's an award-winning photojournalist who works for newspapers here and around the country. And we try to help people. So you try to read the minds. It's hard to read the minds of people that look at photos. And I worry about in general, in other formats, whether they might misplace responsibility for the problem on the people in the community when I think it's an externally motivated crisis. And so And so we put these photos out there, and we try to say, here's the problem, and here's the solution. And what are you thinking when you see this? But you know, I think photography's got a unique power. Right. I was a photographer for a long time, a unique power to bring you there. I love the reaction of readers and colleagues when they've looked at my photos over the years and said, I feel like I was there. So that's the point. I want them to feel like they were there, and next to that, I want to present their alternatives.
There's a photograph of some young boys. They're looking at what had, I guess, clearly been a shooting, and it's a single shot mm-hmm. of these. They look like they're 7 or 8 years old, various expressions on their face, maybe a little bit older, mm-hmm. Looking at something in their neighborhood. It's a powerful photo.
Unfortunately, that reminds me of at least a couple of photos on the site recently and a couple of incidents, so I'm not exactly sure which one you mean. But in either case, yeah, they do the job of bringing right. bringing the viewer along. And now that, you know, we've got your attention on the site, look at these groups and look at these individuals that are working to stop this. Right. And let's talk about some ideas, and let's, you know, tell us what you're thinking.
Well, and Scott, just using that photo as an example, which these are just, they're young boys, they're looking at something that's happened, and you think, of course, about the victims and their families, the perpetrators and their families, but you've got children growing up in not all, but some communities in Philadelphia where violence and shooting is a common occurrence.
Well, absolutely, and I think that this is the greatest challenge that we face is when we talk about trying to put a cap on this problem and to try to wrap our arms around it. What we have to recognize is that with every shooting, you have the individual as the victim and you have the individual as the perpetrator, and we spend a lot of time focusing on those two as being the primary actors in this problem. But when it comes down to it, what you also have to consider is the impact that it has on those who have witnessed it, those who are related, and those who are left behind. And in many ways, the risk that we have is that this kind of violence and this kind of reaction to conflict becomes normative. Mm-hmm. And so for kids growing up in this environment, not only do you have to contend with the grief that they experience, but also the way that this changes them and how this becomes the way that they understand that you deal with you know, conflict and the way you deal with disputes is as they've seen it played out by, you know, adults around them. And they will, unfortunately, expect that this is the way that they'll deal with conflict and disputes.
Also that they would be at risk. I mean, they could be that person lying on the ground.
Well, absolutely. And I think that we can, you know, step back and try to moralize this issue as much as we'd like. But the truth is that when you're growing up in that environment, when you grow up in a neighborhood where violence is commonplace, you begin to understand that when you have this kind of transaction, you'd rather be, you know, judged by 12 than carried by 6.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that's the deal that many of these young folks are making. They're going to be faster on the trigger than the person that they have some type mm-hmm. of disagreement with.
Jim, let me go back to you. Are you also saying something about how the press covers these shootings, even these murders in Philadelphia, that there's a narrative that you're looking for that's missing?
There's I have a concern with the narrative and a concern with a practical reality. The latter I'll mention first is that the industry's in a state of contraction. There are just a lot fewer journalists working in the city, a lot fewer working in the street, and frankly, a lot less experience. So there's one part of the challenge. On the other side, you know, it's too easy to snipe, but broadcast journalism in particular generally brings us this repeated narrative of a young man of whatever age was shot at a corner of this and that so many times, transported to some hospital in whatever condition, and no word, and we'll never know anymore.
Mm-hmm. If it bleeds, it leads, that philosophy?
Yeah, I mean, yes and no. I mean, on the other hand, I think the volume of violence is underrepresented in the media in this city. But what I'm not asking to hear more about violence, but to hear it in a more valuable context and perspective and in conjunction with solutions and what you can do. Here's the problem, and here's what you can do about it.
Let me go back to you, Scott, because your Cradle to Grave program is a unique program. It's in a hospital. Students, I guess, and other young people brought to the hospital to experience what happens during Cradle to Grave.
So every year we bring in about 1,000 kids from various programs. Some are from juvenile justice programs. To a lesser degree, we have individuals coming from traditional schools. But the goal of the program is really, I think, in many ways, to accomplish what Jim is trying to accomplish with guncrisis.org, and that is to humanize this issue. It's if you leave it to the newspapers and you leave it to media, and in the very brief accounts that we have of this violence, it really can be distilled down in our minds, unfortunately, to bad people doing bad things. And what we're trying to accomplish with Cradle to Grave is to bring kids as close to this experience in human terms as we can. And we don't want them to have to experience this firsthand. We hope that through the vicarious experience of bringing a young man to life, a kid who grew up about a mile from the hospital, teaching them about who he was as a young man who was very much like they are, and then kind of explaining some of the mundane circumstances that led up to his shooting the night that he was ultimately killed. We want them to have an appreciation for what this means in human terms, the impact that it had on his family, the impact that it had on the individuals in his community, and the way that this plays out in our hospital. The truth is, as Jim and I have spoken in the past and as we were talking about this morning, is that for a lot of kids, it's either you get shot and survive, or you get shot and you die. And a lot of times we think about gun violence in the context of death. In Philadelphia, we save about 80% of our gunshot patients, and that means that far more often than not, it's not that you're going to die. It's that you're going to survive the shooting and you're going to suffer. And we want them to have a greater appreciation for what that in-between looks like.
And it's really based on a real young man, a young boy named, or a teenager, Lamont Adams. He was born December 10th, 1987. He died September 23rd, 2004. Lived and died in Philadelphia.
Yeah, and the thing that was so, I think, troubling about his death is that he was the victim of a rumor. Individuals that he had grown up with and friends who were friends of friends thought that he had cooperated with the police, and it was really a matter of bad timing. He left a dice game right before the police came, and because the police arrested an individual in the dice game, they thought that he may have cooperated with the police. He literally a day before he would be killed, he sat down with his grandmother, and he took out a pen and he wrote down what would become his obituary. He predicted his death, and unfortunately less than 24 hours later, he was gunned down about a block from his house.
Shot multiple times.
Shot 14 times. He was, by all accounts, a very well-liked, well-respected kid in the neighborhood. But the truth is that he grew up with kids who, because they had dropped out of school, many of these kids found themselves engaged in illegal commerce. They had guns available, and this is how they doled out their punishment.
Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We are talking with Scott Charles, the voice you just heard. He's the Trauma Outreach Coordinator at Temple University Hospital, which is in Philadelphia. He directs their Cradle to Grave program. Also with us is Jim McMillan, co-founder of Gun Crisis Philadelphia Project. He teaches peace and conflict journalism at Swarthmore College, and he also covered the war in Iraq, working for the Associated Press. He was there from 2004 to 2005. Lines open at 1-888-877-9499. We'll be right back.
Music of John Williams, an 80th birthday celebration, Friday, July 20th, featuring the music of Jaws, E.T., Harry Potter, Star Wars, and more. On Saturday, July 21st, get Symphonic Spectacular, dazzling visuals and fireworks, big screen imagery and fireworks accompany classical favorites. Tickets are available at mancenter.org or 215-893-1999. The Man supports WHYY.
Announcing the 2012 WHYY Connections Festival, September 6th through 9th. 4 days of free arts and culture events, including an outdoor concert featuring Yola Tango, Frank Turner, Maps and Atlases, and more, Saturday, September 8th. And on September 9th, performances by Fred Parris and the Five Satins, Charlie Gracie, and more at the Philadelphia Doo-Wop Festival. More artists and events to come. Visit WHYY.org/connectionsfestival.
President Obama and Mitt Romney might want to look over their shoulders. Dr. Jill Stein is running for president on the Green Party banner, and she's pulling no punches.
We need real public servants who listen to the people, not to the corporate lobbyists that funnel campaign checks into the big war chest.
We'll talk with the Green candidate for the White House next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're looking for the solution to the problem of gun violence here in the city of Philadelphia, talking with Scott Charles and Jim McMillan. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Scott, let me just go back to you because I do want to finish Lamont Adams' story in this Cradle to Grave program. The idea is that these young people, they learn about his life. Experience his life.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we do is we walk them up to the events that led to his shooting, and then we pick up the story in the trauma bay. And it's one of the few programs that allows kids to come into the hospital to kind of go behind the scenes. I explain to them that I'm going to take them someplace they wouldn't go unless they were a physician or a victim. And we take them into the trauma bay. We are allowed to use Lamont's medical records. His grandmother, Jenny Clark, was kind enough to grant us permission to share that with these kids. And we'll have medical staff kind of walk the kids through all the procedures that were done in an attempt to save Lamont's life. We'll take a kid from the group, have him lie in, explain that Lamont couldn't be with us today, and that kid will lie in for Lamont. And we painstakingly place little red stickers on the individual in the places where Lamont was shot. And Lamont was shot 14 times. He ultimately had 24 bullet wounds because of the through-and-through gunshot injuries. And it gets incredibly quiet in the trauma bay. You see that these young folks are surprised by all of the things that are done in an attempt to save lives. I mean, again, we have an idea about what gunshot injury is, but it's in no way, shape, or form based in reality. And this is really the reality for us as healthcare mm-hmm. professionals. And we've always thought if we could bring them back here and they could see what we do before they get shot, it may have some benefit, some long-term benefit, because of the fact that I speak to probably a few hundred gunshot patients every year in the hospital. They'll tell me, I wouldn't wish this upon my own worst enemies. Wow. And Dr. Amy Goldberg, who's the chief of trauma surgery at Temple, this was really her brainchild. This is something she's felt passionate about for a couple decades as she's been up there working on young gunshot victims. She knows that once they've gotten shot, they seem far less likely to come back. This is the kind of suffering and the kind of pain that would deter anybody mm-hmm. from the kind of behavior that would bring them back. The problem is that the first time she was seeing these young folks was after they had been shot. And the mm-hmm. idea was, let's bring them in ahead of time. Let's unveil some of the secrecy around this gunshot injury. And let's hope that this impacts their behavior. And based on some of the research that we're doing around Cradle to Grave, it seems to be having some very positive impacts on their attitudes towards guns and violence.
I want to pick up on that. Jim, sure. Let me get you back in on the conversation from your project, Gun Crisis Philadelphia. What have you learned about the reason for gun violence in Philadelphia? Have you come to some kind of conclusions? Do you have a better grasp about what's driving this problem?
It's I'm nowhere near conclusions. I feel like I have a little more of a grasp every day. The funny thing about a startup endeavor is that you'd never really know if you're in your infancy or twilight. But I don't feel like I have a comprehensive view. But this project has enabled me to go out and meet people like Scott week after week this summer. People working in journalism and other anti-violence organizations, academics, and try to paint a picture comprehensively. It's overwhelming. I guess above all, I'm feeling like we've been gridlocked for a very long time. Mm-hmm. I'm concerned with this normalization that Scott brings up, and wondering about how we can disrupt that normalization. And I think perhaps the city, maybe on many levels, has been traumatized by this problem, and we're acting as if it's been broken for so long that we forget that we can fix this.
Well, and this is not the first program by any stretch that Radio Times has done on the problem of gun violence in Philadelphia or in other cities as well. And it seems to me, Scott, we kind of know how to deal with this. I mean, it would if there were after-school programs, if there were support for families in crisis, if we could deal with poverty, if we could deal with unemployment. I realize no easy answers there, but we sort of have a grasp of why we have this problem, it seems to me.
Well, I think it's a moving target, so to speak. And I think that every day that goes by, it's akin to having a hole dug. And as we wait and you know, come up with some strategy, that hole has gotten bigger, more expansive, and deeper. And we then have to go back to the drawing board and then try to address this bigger hole. And I think that this is the problem that we have, that with every day that goes by, you have more and more kids who believe that this is simply a way of life. And, you know, when I started thinking about this issue a decade ago, since then, we've had another generation of kids that has been born in the city of Philadelphia who are growing up in a hostile environment. And we're going to have to figure out what to do with two or three generations now that have grown up in Philadelphia, seeing violence as just a natural way of life. And this is the challenge before us, is getting ahead of this problem.
And a natural way of life, which is that you expect to see it and hear it? Well, it's a way of resolving problems?
Well, I think you expect to see it and hear it. And there's a tremendous amount of fatalism that exists in these neighborhoods. And so for a kid who is contending with some kind of conflict, the fact is that this isn't a great situation that he sees himself in, and he expects that he's not going to live a very long time, and he, as a result of that, will engage in behaviors that suggest that the consequences aren't that tremendous for him.
And the idea of taking this person to a hospital or even talking to them while they're in the hospital, saying, "You got shot, you got wounded, you are in pain." I mean that can be a wake-up call.
Well, I think what you know, as Jim and I have talked about, is that, you know, we want them to engage in the kind of cost benefits analysis that's rooted in reality. And you know, right now for them, many of them think, if I get shot, I may die, or I won't get shot, but I'm going to go ahead and address this conflict and bring a gun to this party. But what we want them to understand is that more often than not, you're not going to die. More often than not, you're going to suffer the kind of pain that, as I said, they would not wish upon their own worst enemy. Mm-hmm. And we just want to tell the truth about what this kind of violence means in real human terms.
Well, Jim, you covered the Iraq War, 2004 to 2005, when things were pretty intense and violent. Do you see any parallels as you look at the violence in Philadelphia between that and what you saw in Iraq?
Well, as we discussed this a little bit earlier, I don't see very many parallels in the nature of the conflict or the likely solutions. The first parallel was my urge, my sense that just honest journalism could make a difference and resolve a conflict. And I'm not taking full credit for the end of that war, but I think I think our team pushed the story in the right direction. In this case, this period isn't going to last forever. And if shining a light on it and empowering those acting to come together and share ideas and to build a community around it can expedite the transformation to a more peaceful time, then you know, that's something worth doing. The most obvious parallel when I look back at Iraq is that nearly as many people were murdered in Philadelphia as American soldiers, as the number of American soldiers who were killed by hostile forces in Iraq during the duration of combat operations. Thousands, around 4,000.
Yeah. Same time period, same one statistic about Iraq, the other statistic about Philadelphia.
Yeah. Another number that I think a whole lot about is that more people have died at the have been murdered in Philadelphia since September 11th than were killed by terrorists on that date. And when you think about our response to, I mean, a horrible day, I was there, in fact, you know, and a horrible day in itself, where this country has gone on and invaded two nations and airport security. Where's the response to what's happened in Philadelphia and similar cities? And why don't we react that way?
Go ahead, Scott.
And I think one of the important contrasts to point out between what's happening here in Philadelphia and what's happening overseas in terms of the conflicts over there is that when when an individual who's fighting in the war over there, at least an American soldier is wounded over there, we pull him out of that conflict. We pull him out of that war zone, and we bring him home, and he's or she is provided resources, and we want to keep them safe, and we want to acknowledge their suffering. The last thing that we would think to do is to send them right back to the war. What we do here is that once an individual's been injured here at home, or you know, in his home, what we do is we patch them up and we send them right back to the very place that brought them to us in the first place. Mm-hmm. We send them right back to the conflict. We rarely provide them the kinds of resources that they would get if they were soldiers fighting overseas. And this is the problem. And now what we're doing is we're multiplying this suffering. We're multiplying these rates of PTSD. And it is an absolute recipe for disaster.
That's Scott Charles, who joins us along with Jim McMillan. We're talking about the problem of violence, much of it gun violence in the city of Philadelphia, and what can be done about it. We have some open lines. I do want to get to our callers now at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Vince from Williamstown to join us. And Vince, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for
You're
taking
welcome.
My call.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to say I lived in Camden for a long time, and I just saw the degeneration of the city as I grew older. I moved when my kids got school age, but I believe that the illegal commerce, I guess as he put it, is just a main factor. You could cut the crime rate in half, or at least the murder rate, if you just legalized certain things that are illegal right now. If a kid can step out of his doorstep, make $1,500, $2,000 in a night, he's going to do it, especially if he doesn't believe he's got opportunities to make money elsewhere. The more money he makes, the further he's going to go to secure that area that he thinks is his. I had a nephew who was killed in Philadelphia about 2 years ago now. And if you saw the pictures of him as a little boy and as he grew up, you would have never believed he would have turned out to be a murder victim. At least I would have never believed. But as he grew up, his father wasn't around, and I guess I didn't take as much time as I could to help mentor him. But I was dealing with my own issues, and I feel guilt for that. Well, as he grew up, he was fearless. He would go out in the middle of the night and ply his trade, and eventually it caught up to him at a very young age. Now, I believe that if he wasn't killed, he would have probably ended up killing somebody else because he was just fearless like that. Mm. Talking to him, he was the most normal, most, you know, happy-go-lucky, always had a smile on his face kid. He just didn't have fear. And I believe that there's just no way around the fact that money causes violence. And if you look at the history of the mob in Chicago, when they repealed Prohibition, a lot of the violence fell off. There was no need to kill anybody anymore. Just my comment.
No, first of all, thank you for that comment. We appreciate that, and you raise a whole host of important issues. And of course, we're very sorry to hear about your nephew. But let me toss this back to you, Scott. He says several things. One is the drug trade, you know, the illegal drug trade. This was a boy that didn't have a father involved in his life. As Vin said, he was fearless. And if he hadn't been killed, he might have killed somebody
sure.
else.
Well, first, I want to acknowledge Vince's loss, and it's incredibly sad. Mm-hmm. You know, the one thing that Vince brought up is the drugs and drug dealing. And based on the conversations I've had time and time again with the individuals who come in and are shot, and many are quite candid about what brought them to us, many are saying that really the drug game, the drug economy has dried up for many of them. I think in many ways it becomes a red herring. A lot of individuals growing up in these neighborhoods are engaged in the drug economy, but that's not really the motivation for shooting. It's about pride. You know, Eli Anderson's Code of the Street brings this up. You know, the truth is this is a hierarchy of dominance. Many of them happen to be dealing drugs, but this is by no means the way that they're getting rich. They're not getting rich. They just happen to be putting food on the table by that means. But a lot of this has to do with pride, and somebody has besmirched them. And you know, they're going to get their pound of flesh.
Their revenge.
Yeah, they're going to get the revenge. And the truth is, I don't know that drugs are the answer, but I think opportunity certainly is the answer. If we give them something that is worth living for, if we created, you know, job opportunities for them, created work so that there was a sense of they have something that they will actually be losing, I think they'd be less inclined to be out there dealing drugs. And certainly when somebody, you know, puts a dent in their ego, they have other means to kind of recover from that. Right now, as Eli points out, that this their pride and their reputation is the one thing that they have, and that's the one thing that they're willing to die for.
Yeah. And Eli Anderson wrote a seminal book a number of years ago, Code of the Streets. Vince, we appreciate that call to Radio Times. Jim, anything you want to add to what both Vince and Scott just said?
Well, I agree with both of them. And Vince, again, I'm sorry for your loss, and I'm glad that you got to share that story. I guess what I think about in the big picture is that I was paralyzed for such a long time, and I think a lot of us are, because we can look at the maelstrom of poverty and guns and drugs and say, where do we begin? How do we address this? But just in the last year, and this project was based on the idea of what if we can just stop the shooting? What if we can just stop the killing or reduce the shooting at least? And so when you think about this sort of a young man in this situation, maybe he didn't have a lot of job opportunities, not a lot of community opportunities, maybe not everything, all the tools he needed. But in that moment where people reach for a gun, pull for a trigger, where violence is escalating, that's maybe where we can touch in to stop the violence, to help a young man understand that their actions have ramifications and that they have choices in that moment, and that they're not just affecting their adversary in that moment, but the two families at least, you know.
There's an amazing documentary, The Interrupters. Exactly. It's based in Chicago, mm-hmm. and it's about a number of people that, I mean, just get in the face of some of these young people to try to interrupt that thinking or that response.
And we've got a small, well, Scott probably knows more, we've got a small model of that emerging at Temple already.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'd be remiss if I didn't point out that Temple's Temple University School of Medicine, Marla Davis Bellamy is running Ceasefire Philadelphia, and we're collaborating with her at the hospital. And they, as Jim points out, they have a model of this that was, you know, originally started in Chicago, and we're now using it here in North Philadelphia, mm-hmm. in the 22nd Police District. And it's very encouraging. I mean, you have young men that are part of Ceasefire who know the streets, who know these circumstances, who will respond in the wake of a shooting and try to help cooler heads to prevail. And I think, you know, it's going to take a number of approaches. And at Temple, we're trying to wrap our minds and our arms around this issue. Mm-hmm. We're doing prevention with Cradle to Grave. We've started an intervention program called Turning Point that is trying to do what I mentioned with regard to the individuals who were injured in Iraq. We're working with Temple University's School of Psychiatry and Psychology to help counsel these individuals. And then we've got Ceasefire that's working in the mm-hmm. communities. And then I think it's going to take a lot of different approaches, but we've got, as Jim said, we can't be paralyzed.
But what I hear you both saying is that it's yes, there's the punitive approach, the juvenile or the justice system, but this is about relationships, right? It's about interactions.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think that we as Sylvester Johnson, the former police commissioner, was fond of saying, we're not going to arrest our way out of this problem, nor are we going to be able to patch it up in the hospital. And those seem to be the two ways that we kind of focus our energies, is both in the hospital and the criminal justice system. But it has to be beyond that. We're going to have to step outside of the hospital to help address this issue. And police officers are going to have to do more than just put handcuffs on individuals.
Let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's Scott Charles. He's the Trauma Outreach Coordinator for Temple University Hospital, Director of the Cradle to Grave Program. Jim McMillan, co-founder of Gun Crisis Philadelphia Project. He also teaches at Swarthmore College. We'll be calling down to Wilmington, Delaware after this very short break, and we'll get some more callers in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Rider University supports WHYY and offers master's degree programs in business, education, and psychology. New to Rider's master's degree program is their Master of Arts in Business Communication. Rider's next graduate information session is tonight, July 18th, from 6 to 8 p.m. The information session will feature details about their flexible schedules designed to accommodate busy adults. Registration is available online at rider.edu/grad or at 800-257-9026.
On the next Fresh Air, David Kirkpatrick, Cairo Bureau Chief for the New York Times, talks about the new president of Egypt, Mohamed Morsi, a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, and what his election means for the U.S., Israel, and the Palestinians. Kirkpatrick is a former Times Washington correspondent and covered the American conservative movement. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. How did 27 cities in Pennsylvania end up in dire financial straits? Also, the London Olympics had so few private security personnel they had to call in the army. So how secure is London going forward? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We've been talking about the problem of violence and gun violence here in the city of Philadelphia. Joining us now is Yvonne Bunch, and she is the Prevention and Community Coordinator in Wilmington, Delaware. And Yvonne, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Well, I'm glad I was able to join you today, and thank you for inviting us.
You're very welcome. And I was reading about a recent tragic killing in a park in Wilmington that was at a soccer match. Three people were actually killed. Has that sad and violent incident gotten some focus on the problem of violence in Wilmington?
Yes, but I'm pleased to announce that we started our efforts prior to that that violence incident in the park. The governor, to help address the recent rise in gun violence affecting several communities within the city, Delaware Governor Jack Markell has committed resources from the Delaware Department of Services for Children, Youth, and Their Families to provide funding to 10 community centers in the city. By providing this funding, it allows the community centers to extend their hours of operation and provide supervised educational and structure activities for our teens in a safe environment.
That tells us that young people need things to do to stay out of trouble?
It's important that, yes, you're right. It's important that we provide alternative activities to teens and young people so that they have in a safe and structured environment versus being on the streets. So they'd be able to come to one of these community centers throughout the city, and again, it's 10 community centers, where they're able to participate in structure activities such as substance abuse prevention workshops, computerized-based structured sessions and curricula, recreation activities, suicide prevention classes, anti-bullying workshops, all in an effort to provide a safe haven and a safe environment for our kids.
And are the kids coming?
The kids are coming. The center's been open since June 18th. The kids are coming. So far, we have served over 500 kids in the various community centers. So the kids are coming.
I know that there, like a lot of other cities, there are curfew centers in Wilmington. Mm-hmm. How does that work?
Well, we do have a curfew center. This for the second summer. We funded a curfew center with the Wilmington Police Department, and it's located at the YMCA, and it's for children aged 13 to 17. It's going very well. Last year, we served over 200 kids, and so far to date, we have served 40 kids through the curfew center. So it's going very well.
And Wilmington has a curfew?
Yes, we do. And the curfew is in effect from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. Sunday through Thursday nights, and midnight, 6 a.m. on Friday and Saturday nights.
So it sounds like in Wilmington, Delaware, at least, there are efforts to provide some of these community environments for young people. What about the idea of coordinating between agencies, getting families together along with the police department and other aspects of government, maybe even religious people, coming together to try to figure out how to prevent violence?
Well, in Delaware, we are very actively involved with the faith-based community. the Interdenominational Ministerial Action Council. They have endorsed this plan. They are 100% behind it. And they're very involved and active at the table. And one of my jobs for the summer months, I will be overseeing the citywide prevention activities funded by the state to ensure that funds put towards the efforts are used effectively and to coordinate the state's efforts with other prevention initiatives administered by the city and community organizations. Because what we do know is in order to really curb violence in Delaware, it's going to require a comprehensive approach and buy-in and commitment from all partners and sectors, state government, city government, county government. We need the business community, the faith community. We need all sectors involved.
And are you optimistic that you can address this problem?
Yes, I am, with a comprehensive approach.
Well, Yvonne Bunch, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And she's the Prevention and Community Coordinator in Wilmington, Delaware. And we do want to continue our conversation with Jim McMillan and Scott Charles, who are with us here in our Philadelphia studios. And I do want to get back to our callers. Just a quick response, if I could, from both of you. And what I hear, and this is a model that has been used in other cities, which is to bring everybody together. And maybe even people that have served time in prison or have gotten in trouble and have them all around the table. Is that a model that works, Scott, do you think?
Well, I think it certainly can when you have a community that is as geographically and from a population standpoint small as, right. as Delaware, Wilmington, Delaware specifically. I think there's a fantastic opportunity to kind of mobilize individuals working in this area. There's a group called YESS down in Wilmington that I've had the benefit of working with, and they've been on this issue for a very long time. In fact, they've put together anti-violence summits, and I know they're responding to this. And I think it's great. I think that the problem we have here locally is that this seems like such an expansive problem, and it seems there's so many players that you know that want to be involved, and it's hard to get them together. And I know, Jim, that this is really where your passion
sure.
lies.
Sure, sure.
Right. So there's one of our primary motivations is to build that table to and it's just beginning. We're like I said, we're in our infancy, but to make a place at least digitally where everybody can come together and find the information they need, a comprehensive database of resources and organizations. I met with some resistance from colleagues when I started, saying that this is crazy. This community isn't online, but I find them online every night. I find very specific search terms in our site of the names of victims. I respond, and I see a lot on Twitter. I scour Twitter and Facebook, and there's memorialization. There's a lot of head shaking and a lot of people seeking solutions. Mm. And so do I think I can get everybody there? I don't know, but for all the people that are able to gather digitally, I want to make this the place.
Let me get, looks like Mike from South Jersey to join our conversation. And Mike, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I just think that there is not enough emphasis in reining in the access to guns in Pennsylvania. And it's not surprising because the Pennsylvania legislature is owned lock, stock, and barrel, pun intended, by the gun lobby. The National Rifle Association holds incredible power over the Pennsylvania legislature, and it was evidenced in the last few years when we saw the legislature overturn laws that were enacted by Philadelphia and many other cities to control access and trafficking of guns at a local level. So, you know, the reality is that the legislators, and we have to say, you know, we have to call a spade a spade. It's mostly driven by the Republican Party at a national and state level, and they stand by and watch the blood flow in the streets.
Well, Mike, let's not get carried away here, and let's keep the focus on gun laws, even in Pennsylvania. And let me actually toss your comments to Scott Charles, which is, I mean, the gun laws are the gun laws. They're not going to be overturned, certainly not while we're talking about this on the air. I think we're going to have to figure out how to live with guns.
Yeah, sad to say. I'm not ready to give up on creating more responsible gun legislation. And I think I want to be clear that I'm speaking as an individual citizen of Philadelphia, not a representative of the of Temple Health System. But as an individual living here in the city, it terrifies me to know that guns are so readily accessible, that you can literally go into a gun shop and within 30 minutes pick out a handgun and walk out. If you're a felon, it's easy enough to have a friend who doesn't have a criminal record and kind of go in and do a straw purchase for you. And until we can figure out that problem, we are going to have to contend with the fact that there's a plethora of guns that are in our neighborhoods, and they're not going anyway, going away anytime soon.
We have to figure out how to live with them, Jim?
Well, I've got no argument to the contrary of our caller. And yet, if you in our mission statement, our strategy is to specifically avoid polarizing debates such as gun control, policing, sentencing, and to focus on new solutions to uncover new ideas. And yet, at the same time, we landed on the title for the site because we didn't want to pull any punches. It's a gun crisis. Over nearly 10,000 people have been murdered in Philadelphia over the last 25 years, the average of about one per day. And in more than three quarters of the cases, they've been killed with guns. Guns are part of the problem, no doubt about it. I'm not advocating a solution. I'm looking for the solutions.
Fair enough. Let me see what Tom from Philadelphia has to say. Tom, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, is that me, Tom from Philly?
Yeah, you are. You're Tom from Philly. Go ahead.
Okay, good. What I had said, and I think it'll make sense to you, I work in the school system. I've been substituting for 8.5 years. I'm going back again this year. I work in a lot of schools with, you know, young guys that are going, they tell them sometimes, they even go off and go to jail. But anyway, what I see these kids doing, and I love the kids, but they hit each other because they like each other. Mm. Now, I don't know if that could make any sense to anybody here. You can make an argument for it, but what I see starting out in about the fourth grade is they smack each other around. The girls do it, the guys do it. Sometimes the guys even hit the girls, and the girls hit the guys back. And they're doing it because they like each other. I don't know. That's all I really got to say.
It's interesting. And again, Scott, let me toss that back to you.
I hit every girl that I like as a rule. One of the problems with that we have to confront when it comes to urban culture right now is that we've really distilled it down to three kind of primary things. When you look at urban culture, it's come down to aggression, it's come down to sexuality, it's come down to materialism. Aggression is a big piece of the problem. We communicate in very hostile ways. That's absolutely right. But I think that we've got to not just simply look at that as being bad culture, but we've got to say, well, what are the solutions, or what are the potential answers for that? And I think one of the keys is giving people something to value. And you know, when you look at what's going on in these neighborhoods, it's really no surprise that when you don't have when you have a tremendous amount of fatherlessness, when you've got a high level of fatalism, when you have unemployment, undereducation, and those types of things, violence seems like a natural extension of what's going on in these communities. So, you know, in terms of how, you know, whether hitting somebody leads to somebody being shot, I think there's a cheapening of life. I admit that, but I don't know that I'm ready to say that a boy hitting a girl that he likes is ultimately going to lead to somebody being shot. But I will say that I think that there is some one of the things that I think Jim and I were talking about a while ago is that I think that there's a level of resentment that young men have towards their fathers who are absent in Philadelphia. You know, we have to be honest that this is a problem that doesn't cut across racial lines. You have, you know, somewhere around 80% of gunshot victims being young African-American men. In Philadelphia, somewhere close to 80% of African-American children are born to single moms. Fathers are oftentimes out of that equation. And so it's hard to take a kid who hasn't known his father, hasn't had this significant male figure in his life, have a respect for any other man. Because when I ask young men, who are you willing to live for? And more importantly, who are you willing to die for? They'll never say their fathers. And really? When I ask them why, they say, I simply don't know him. And I suspect that you know, underlying what we're seeing there is a real resentment towards men in their lives, or men more appropriately, men who've been absent from their lives.
Men who maybe have abandoned them,
yeah.
or certainly are not
yeah.
in their lives. And as Vince described, that was certainly true for his nephew. Let me go back to you, Jim. I'm looking at the clock here. A couple of more minutes before we have to say goodbye. And anyone that wants to give us a call, just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. So what do you hope this project, Gun Crisis, what do you want it to do? I mean, I realize you want to address this problem, figure out some kind of solutions, look for maybe things that we haven't talked about or haven't used to try to address this problem.
And ultimately to build a community and to reduce violence, of course. And the last call, you know, I don't know what to make of that example of,
yeah.
of children hitting each other. But what I'm learning is that so many people that I meet react very differently to the same information. And I know that's in some ways the nature of trauma, but there are also cultural differences. So in terms of, for example, news reporting, I've found very few follow-up stories this year on violence, very few solutions-based stories. But there was one last week that I liked, and I thought, like, well, this is progressive. And then I went to an event later that evening and heard one bereaved mom tell another, that story was so full of hate. And she was focused on a different aspect because it was calling for a more authoritarian response than some others think is best. But I'm just realizing what completely different reactions we all have. And I just and so that's why we've built this thing. On our site, you can communicate publicly, privately, or even anonymously in a couple of ways. And I want people to step up and say, you know, what are we doing right? What are we getting wrong? What's your idea? Help us. Talk. Let's communicate.
Well, and there aren't either or solutions, are there, Scott?
No, I mean, I think that I think Jim's pointed out there really, you know, there's no one panacea for this issue. But we're going to have to approach it from a number of ways and take different approaches for different people. Mm. And there, you know, fortunately, there are a lot of individuals here in Philadelphia trying to address this issue. Some are doing tremendous work. Some are you know, doing heartfelt work that may, you know, only benefit a few, but they're doing work. And this is the key, is that we can't give up this. We have to, you know, have a call to action. And I think the thing that I've respected most about the work that Jim's doing is the fact that everybody who has seen that website seems compelled to say something, to do something, and to reach out as a result of having experienced it.
Well, my thanks to both of you for joining us, and also thanks for your work. It's such an important issue. Thanks.
Thank you, Marty.
Thanks for being with us. And Scott Charles is the Trauma Outreach Coordinator at Temple University Hospital. He directs the Cradle to Grave program. It's an award-winning hospital-based violence prevention program. Jim McMillan, co-founder of Gun Crisis Philadelphia Project, and as he has been describing, it's an open-source reporting community addressing the epidemic of gunfire and homicide by gunfire in Philadelphia. He teaches peace and conflict journalism as the journalist in residence at Swarthmore College. And back 2004 to 2005, he was in Iraq covering that war for the Associated Press, part of a team of people that won a Pulitzer Prize. Go to WHYY.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.